TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Extinction Rebellion, Dr. Rupert Reed. In October 2018, about 100 academics signed a call to action. They established Extinction Rebellion in the United Kingdom. The movement has become international, with Naomi Klein, Vandana Shiva, and Noam Chomsky signing their support to the second letter. The goal of Extinction Rebellion is to use nonviolent resistance to bring about radical change to prevent climate collapse, loss of biodiversity, and to reduce the risk of human extinction. Dr. Rupert Reed is teaching philosophy at the University of East Anglia. He's a longtime Green Party politician and former Green Party spokesperson for transport. Here's a talk he gave on February 6, 2019, at the University of East Anglia.
Let me start by telling you a story of a species that was asleep. And when it woke up, it saw the doom that it had created already for so many other species, and that it had now trapped itself on a path of self-imposed death. It saw its own doom, and it trembled in fear, and it wept. But then it realized that it wasn't fully awake yet. There was a further step it had to take to become awakened, to become enlightened. And that was to realize, hang on a minute, we're not spectators of this. This story isn't over yet. It's wrong to tell it as if it's over. We can rebel against this doom, against this path to extinction. If we see clearly what we've done, the state we're in, the path ahead, the doom that seems inevitable, well, that seeing is the beginning of the one and only way in which it might yet not be inevitable. Because we're not spectators. We are agents. We are potential agents of change, and we have no idea what we are capable of until we try. We can rebel against the very predictable results of our present path. If we dare to look the reality of what we've done to life on Earth and what we've done to our very climate in the face, then two things. Firstly, we can prepare for our possible doom. And if we're potentially going to fail to prevent that doom, as looks objectively probable, then we'd better get on with preparing to meet it. And secondly, we can prepare ourselves to seek to give our all to prevent it. This talk is about those two kinds of preparations, about adaptation to a possible coming fate, and about the heroic attempt to prevent that fate. This talk is about how it looks like we're doomed, but also about how it only looks like that only if we only look. If we picture ourselves as spectators. But if instead we step into our full power as agents of change, capable of extraordinary, beautiful, unprecedented, unknowable things, then objective assessment of probabilities suddenly all becomes moot. And instead it's about our freedom to create something new, something historic, something glorious, right in the teeth of the darkness of this time. But first, why think that a sober assessment of probabilities would lead us to conclude that we are doomed? Won't international action save us from climate catastrophe? No. Sorry. The answer is no. Let me spend a little while talking with you about why the Paris Climate Change Agreement will not save us. So the Paris Climate Change Agreement, a few years ago now, was an absolutely historic, unprecedented, extraordinary diplomatic achievement. Every country in the world had to agree for this climate agreement to be made. And they did. And what they agreed to was really about the most that you could expect the countries of the world all together to agree to. They agreed to work together to make changes to reduce our carbon emissions so that we don't destroy ourselves. Very good so far. But there are some problems, some very, very big problems, which I'm now going to briefly outline. So let's start with the fact that this was a few years ago. What have we had since then? Since then, we've had growing scientific evidence of how desperate our plight is, including, for example, the huge amount of heat that's trapped in the oceans, much huger than we realise, which is committing us to further dangerous climate change for a long time to come. We've seen our weather start to really spiral out of control just in those last few years since Paris, and that's part of what's waking a lot of people up to what's happening. And perhaps worst of all, we've seen absolutely incredibly at this moment in history, we've seen the election of Donald Trump in the USA and of Bolsonaro in Brazil, about the two worst leaders you could possibly imagine in about the two most important countries in the entire world for dealing with this awesome crisis. So things have got a lot worse since the Paris Agreement was signed, tragically, on balance. But it's worse than that, because even on its own terms, the Paris Agreement is profoundly inadequate to the situation that we're in. Firstly, the Paris Agreement basically aims to keep our global climate to within 2 degrees of overheat compared to pre-industrial levels. But most scientists think that isn't actually a safe level. That's why more recently they've been talking about 1.5 degrees, which is pretty much of an impossible target. So even what Paris is aiming for is not enough. The way that Paris intends us to get there is through voluntary contributions to that target by countries around the world. Voluntary contributions, bit of a worry there. And those contributions, you add them all up, and people have done this, and they add up to considerably less than is necessary to keep us within 2 degrees. They probably take us to somewhere around 3 degrees of global overheat. It doesn't end there, unfortunately. These are simply targets. These are aspirations made, as I say, voluntarily by the governments of the world. But you have to ask yourself this question. If those aspirations run up against other plans that those governments have, which is going to win? So one way of posing the question is to think of it like this. On the one hand, you've got the climate change minister saying, well, look, we signed up to these targets in Paris. And on the other hand, you've got the business minister and the Chancellor of the Exchequer saying, yeah, and this is what we need for economic growth and infrastructure development and so on. Now, when you have the climate change minister on the one hand arguing against the Chancellor of the Exchequer and the business minister on the other hand, well, I leave it to you to figure out who's going to win that one. Most countries of the world, just about all countries in the world, have plans for industrial growth, for economic growth, for infrastructure growth, which directly contradict their voluntary agreement under the Paris Climate Change Agreement. Extremely worrying. But that's not the end of it. The IPCC process itself, the UN process itself, needs to be critiqued. You may not be aware that the summary documents which the IPCC comes up with are not produced by scientists. They're produced by, or at least they're edited, by politicians and civil servants. This is not an objective process. Moreover, even the IPCC bit, the scientists bit themselves, the scientists have to agree among themselves, and this is a kind of process of a sort of lowest common denominator. Mostly what you have in the IPCC reports is a sort of bare minimum of what we can expect in terms of how bad things are going to be. Leading-edge predictions of how bad things could be rarely get in there, and it's those that we should be worried about now. Why is that? Another reason why the IPCC process itself is problematic is because it doesn't take proper account of feedbacks. In the recent 1.5 degree report, for example, there was virtually nothing about the fact that the Arctic ice cap, as you probably know, is melting. And this is meaning that there is less whiteness reflecting the sun's rays out back into space again. And you're starting to get a vicious feedback there. As more of the sun's rays come in and hit dark sea, more of them get absorbed, and that increases the temperature further, and then more ice melts, and you see where that's going. That's not even the scariest feedback. The scariest feedback, which is completely ignored almost in the IPCC process, is the potential methane feedback. As we melt the permafrost especially, and as we melt ice also under the seabed, we are starting to release significant amounts of methane. Methane is a greenhouse gas that is somewhere between 25 and 86 times, depends how you calculate, as powerful as carbon dioxide. And some scientists are worried that once this methane effect starts really going, it will be uncontrollable and we'll have runaway climate change. You put all these points together, and what it suggests is that on the Paris trajectory, we're headed for something like 4 degrees, 5 degrees of global overheat, probably this century. That is incompatible with civilization as we know it. That is incompatible with an industrial growth-based society. And I haven't even mentioned possibly the worst thing of all, the really dirty secret about the Paris Agreement, which is to reach its targets later on this century, it presupposes that we will use the technologies of so-called climate engineering or geoengineering, the idea that we can engineer the climate of the whole planet, an extremely, how shall we put it, bold ambition. There are two problems with the technologies proposed for this bold ambition. The first is that they don't exist. And that's more or less a literal statement of fact. The only ones that do exist haven't been trialed at scale, and there's very little reason to believe that they would work at scale. Secondly, if they were used at scale, if they were trialed, well, it would be an extremely, extremely reckless thing to do. We're talking about things like putting mirrors in space. We're talking about things like attempting to suck vast amounts of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, or attempting to replicate natural cloud effects with artificial clouds that could radically alter our weather. These technologies, these techno fixes, are incredibly dangerous and reckless. So the first problem with these technologies, which are presupposed by the Paris Agreement, is that they don't exist. And the second problem is that if they did exist, we almost certainly shouldn't use them. So what conclusion should one draw from this? Well, I already said it. If we stick to what's intended under the Paris Agreement, then during this century and possibly during the next generation, this civilization will be finished. Industrial growth society will be over. We're talking about collapse. We're talking about the potential for a series of events which will make the Second World War look relatively minor. This is about whether we, and especially anyone younger than about 30 or 40 in this room, has a future. Industrial growth society is finished. It is doomed. If we manage to go along with what is intended under the Paris Agreement, never mind if we don't achieve it, the best ambitions that our governments have for us mean that the societies that they run are finished. They are not going to be sustained. They are doomed. But the fact that they are doomed have to mean that we are doomed. That is the question that we now must turn to. It seems to me that in this situation, there are three possibilities. There are three realistic possibilities for the form that the end of industrial growth society will take. It's going to happen. Which of these three scenarios will play out? The first scenario I've already gestured at, that our societies will collapse completely, that this incredibly thin layer, which is our atmosphere, will continue to heat up, and that will not be compatible with life as we know it. In particular, the first thing that is likely to give, although there are many possibilities, is our food systems. We already got a little hint of that last summer. Imagine if the heat wave that we'd had last summer had gone on, as it quite easily could have done, on into September. We were already getting major crop losses. One little example, onion crop in East Anglia down 25 to 30%. How many summers like that can the vast numbers that we have sustain? This is the first possibility, and I put it first because objectively it now looks like it's the most likely. But here's the second possibility, and this may not sound great, but actually I think it's quite exciting in some ways and quite realistic. Maybe we will manage to seed a successor society to it, to what we have, as this society collapses. And that is now something that we have to give serious attention to thinking about. It's not enough anymore to pretend that if we just keep trying to mitigate climate change in the way we have been doing, that we are going to succeed in saving ourselves and saving some version of this society, we have to consider the possibility of some kind of massive collapse event. And we have to think about how we can try to help whatever comes after that, if anything comes after that, if we manage to have anything come after that, if we don't get some kind of runaway dangerous climate change produced by the methane feedback, for example. We have to think about what that could be like and how we could foster it. This is a picture of the seed bank at Svalbard, which some of you will be aware of, which tries to keep seeds, large numbers of diverse seeds, intact for possible future generations to use after some kind of collapse event. Now, tragically, what happened recently, as some of you will have heard, is that the Svalbard seed bank started to melt. Because Svalbard, many of you will know about Svalbard, for example, from Philip Pullman's marvelous Northern Lights book, Land of Snow and Ice, but the Arctic has been exposed to these absolutely insane temperatures over the last year, 20 or 30 degrees above seasonal normals. So the seed bank started to melt and emergency work was needed to keep it intact. We have to think about how to keep this kind of thing intact, how to do it even more creatively. Various ways, this is just an example of how we can try to help whoever may come after us if this society collapses to rebuild something different and better. That's the second possibility, and I'm saying we need to think about it more than we have done so far. The third possibility, this society will somehow manage to transform itself. We will somehow manage to transform ourselves radically and rapidly in an unprecedented manner in time to avert collapse. So, industrial growth society as we know it is finished, but that doesn't have to mean that there has to be a collapse event in which there are multiple holocausts. It could be averted if we do something completely unprecedented, and that's what I call transformation. So we should aim for this possibility, number three, but we should also, as an insurance policy, take action that conduces to possibility number two being available and to try to avoid at all costs possibility number one. So those three possibilities, which are we going to plump for? What is to be done? Given this situation, what is to be done? I'm going to suggest seven things that we need to do in this unprecedented historic challenge that we now face. Firstly, there we go. Wake up, freak out. Hopefully you're already doing a bit of that, the very fact that you're here, and then the fact you've heard what I've said so far. And of course, it's not enough just for you as an individual to wake up. Try to get all your friends and family and workmates, teachers, whoever it might be, to wake up and to freak out as well. The more of us who do it together, the more of an impact there's going to be. This is not something which is easy to do, by the way. It's not a kind of one-off event. It's very easy to think, well, yeah, I've woken up to this. I've acknowledged that this is the reality. And then to keep on sliding back into the assumption that we can just sort of go on with our lives most of the time in the same way that we do. If you're really going to do this, it's going to require a lot of thought, a lot of concentration, and then starting to think about which of your practices you want to change. You know, what things do you want to give up? What things do you want to, for example, maybe do now rather than later? Because there might not be a later in the way you've imagined. Secondly, so I've already gestured at this, work to transform the society, including through what my think tank Greenhouse following the UN calls transformative adaptation. Why am I talking about transformative adaptation? What does that mean? Well, as I've already said, it is no longer enough for us to think, when we think about dangerous climate change, only about climate mitigation. That is no longer credible. We are now committed to dangerous climate change, which is going to get worse for a long time to come, whatever we do, even if we do the absolute best we can. Because as I gestured at a little while ago, there are time lags in the system. There is this vast amount of heat in the ocean. Methane lasts 20, 25 years in the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide lasts hundreds of years in the atmosphere. If we were to stop all emissions tomorrow, the climate situation would go on getting worse for a considerable time to come. Right? It is not credible anymore to think, yes, we just have to solve this problem. We just have to stop producing so many emissions. No, we are going to have to adapt. And we're going to have to adapt in this way, which we call transformative, because the kind of shallow adaptation The kind of mainstream adaptation which is involved in doing things like just building higher dikes or seawalls, for example, to deal with flood risks, that isn't good enough. Why isn't that good enough? Firstly, it's not good enough because it's actually productive itself of greenhouse gas emissions, right? We have to think of ways of adapting which are simultaneously ways of mitigating if we're not going to make the situation worse and worse, yeah? We can't adapt in ways that are themselves fossil fuel heavy. And secondly, we have to be fleet-footed in our adaptation. We have to try to create a society which is going to be ready for continual change in our climate and difficult situations for a long time to come. We are in the early stages of a very long emergency. And to get through that emergency, we're going to have to adapt to the difficult changes that are coming, and we're going to have to do so transformatively, in a way that ultimately transforms our society into the kind of flourishing, very different society that we need. But that actually isn't enough. We also have to accept that this effort to transform society may well fail. Because as I started out by sketching, the situation is very grim, and we are facing massive forces of ignorance, massive forces of vested interests which are going to find it very difficult to adapt. We have to face the reality that we've left this all awfully late. We may well fail. We may well fail to transformatively adapt, let alone to mitigate adequately. Therefore, we also need what my friend and colleague Jim Bendel calls deep adaptation. What is deep adaptation? Adaptation that is deep is adaptation that accepts, at least hypothetically, that collapse is probable. Or highly probable, or some people, they think it's inevitable. So deep adaptation says, what if we do experience a collapse event? What then? So this is like the kind of thinking that I talked about a few minutes ago when I talked about we have to think about how to seed a successor civilization. So deep adaptation says things like, okay, if society does start to collapse, what kind of things will we need to do to stop that collapse from becoming self-fulfilling, from becoming worse and worse? So here's one very prominent example. Some people think that nuclear power is a way which we might be able to help ourselves solve the problem of greenhouse gas emissions and high fossil fuel use and growth in global temperatures. But when you look at the issue that we're facing from the perspective of thinking, we have to start to face up to the possibility that there may well be some kind of collapse event, nuclear power starts to look completely different, right? Because nuclear power produces waste that remains toxic for, well, hundreds of thousands of years, and highly toxic for hundreds of years. And it needs to be carefully guarded during that period. I don't just mean guarded against terrorists, although that's obviously one thing it needs to be guarded against. I mean, you've got literally rods of spent fuel, which are in pools, and these pools have to be kept there constantly. If the pool goes dry, then within about 12 to 24 hours, the spent fuel rods will catch fire. And if they catch fire and the fire is not put out, the fires will burn for decades or hundreds of years, spewing toxic waste into the atmosphere. So picture some kind of collapse event across Russia, say, where suddenly all the nuclear power stations are abandoned and they cease to have power going to them, they cease to be maintained. In very, very short order, you get not only meltdowns of cores of nuclear power stations, but just the waste that is left over starts to become an unbelievably potent and horrendous health hazard for ourselves and our non-human kin. This is the kind of thing that we need to be thinking about now if we seriously believe, as I've suggested we must, that collapse is objectively probable or at least something which we need to very seriously consider. So we need to be thinking now about how to make these nuclear power stations safe, not for God's sake building more, and about how we can make nuclear waste relatively safe. That is a prime example of deep adaptation. Deep adaptation is sort of an ultimate insurance policy. It says, given that we now cannot rule out, at the very least, we cannot rule out that there may be some kind of major prolonged collapse event, partially or completely, we need to be taking steps now to try to put ourselves and whoever comes after us in the best possible position to survive that kind of event. So that's the third thing. Not just transformative adaptation, but deep adaptation. Fourthly, well, by this point in the talk, maybe you're upset. Maybe you're feeling angry. Maybe you're feeling grief. Maybe you're feeling terror. Well, whatever it is, feel it. And this is one of the very things which I think is very exciting about Extinction Rebellion, that it has gone against the mainstream in environmental thinking. For so long, people have been saying things like, oh, we've got to tell a positive story, we've got to remain optimistic, we've got to convince everybody that we can change everything for the better, and it's not going to be that difficult. And if we all just make a real effort and put in low-energy light bulbs, then basically everything's going to be fine. And even if it's not, we've got to pretend that it is, because if you get people scared, they will turn off, they'll become apathetic. No, forget all of that. Now is the time for authenticity. Now is the time for telling the truth. Now is the time for being real about how bad this is and using our feelings, right? And not just pretending that some kind of rational policy wonk fantasy is going to solve this, because it's not. So feel your anger, feel your grief, whatever it is, feel your despair. Don't get stuck in it, but feel it. And then work through it. Feel your terror. And when you've done all that, then you're in the best position to do this. Rebel. The time is now for mass, non-violent, direct action. We've tried plenty of other stuff, and I'm not saying don't do that other stuff. Yeah, sure. Continue to write to your MP, continue to lobby, continue obviously to try to live lightly upon the earth. Rob mentioned that I'm in the Green Party. I think that ordinary political action continues to be very important. I personally would say to you, join the Green Party, vote Green, stand for election, whatever. That's all really, really good. It's all really, really necessary. We need everything. But don't be fooled into thinking that those things alone, those conventional things, are going to be enough. They're not going to be enough. We need an absolute step change. We need it rapidly, and we need it for a long time. And the best idea that we have is this. The best idea that we have is to say, the societies that are committing us to oblivion, the governments that are committing us to oblivion, the governments that are planning, when you look at the realities of the Paris Climate Change Accord, that are planning for the self-destruction of the societies which they've created and which we depend upon, these governments are no longer legitimate, right? How can a government be legitimate which is engaged in a sort of mass criminal conspiracy to not only destroy even more of the non-human life on Earth? We've destroyed half the non-human life on Earth during my lifetime. I mean, it's so unbelievable and so tragic. You can say it as many times as you like, and it's almost impossible to compute. So there's that, and then the fact that we are now putting ourselves on the endangered species list. How can such governments expect us to go along with their laws any longer? It is time, it is high time, it is past time for us to say no, and for us to be freed up from the assumptions of political business as usual by the awesome horror of the situation that we now find ourselves in.
That was part one of a longer talk and conversation with Dr. Rupert Weed. He's teaching philosophy at the University of East Anglia and has been a longtime Green Party politician and a co-founder of Extinction Rebellion. Come back when TU Civedio returns for part of the conversation with the audience. You can hear this program again for free on TU Civedio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelöden. Thank you for listening.